Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with historian Rebecca Scott, co-author of Freedom Papers, An Atlantic Odyssey in the Age of Emancipation, and Candace Proctor, who writes as C.S. Harris, about her new Regency set mystery, When Maidens Mourn. Rebecca Scott is the Charles Gibson Distinguished University Professor of History and Professor of Law at the University of Michigan. She holds degrees from Radcliffe, the London School of Economics, and Princeton University, and is the recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship, as well as many prestigious awards. One of her areas of great expertise is Louisiana history. Her first book was Degrees of Freedom, Louisiana and Cuba After Slavery, which won the prestigious John Hope Franklin Prize. Her new book, written with co-author Jean Hibrard, is Freedom Papers, An Atlantic Odyssey in the Age of Emancipation, just out from Harvard University Press. Welcome to The Reading Life, Rebecca.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to join you.
You've said that this story began, as so many do, with an accident in the archives. I love that phrase. Would you tell us about it?
Yes. Well, as you know, I was really trained as a specialist in the history of Cuba. And each year I go to the archives in Havana and I work through documents related to the history of Cuba. And I was working with the papers of General Máximo Gómez, who was one of the leaders of the Cuban War of Independence. And all of a sudden, here was an incoming letter typed in purple ink on letterhead from a cigar company in Belgium. And it spoke of New Orleans, it spoke of Haiti, and it seemed to suggest that the writer, although he was a Belgian cigar maker, had been connected with many of the leading events in Louisiana history and even before that in the Haitian Revolution. So I needed to figure out if it was true. Was he just making up stories, or was there somehow a family itinerary here that would help link the history of Cuba, Haiti, and New Orleans?
And sure enough.
His name was Edward Tinchon, and the letter was dated 1899. And my co-author, Jean Hibrard, and I have been working on this now for 6 years, and we've tracked two generations back from Edouard to his grandmother, who was taken as a captive in West Africa and deported to the French colony of Saint-Domingue. And then we've moved forward to the generation of his grandniece.
Well, it's a sweep of the story that is so astonishing. From Senegambia in 1785 to Haiti to Cuba to New Orleans to France to Belgium. And so much of it takes place in New Orleans, which seems to reinforce what a central role our city played in that period.
It does, and it's interesting that he identifies New Orleans as a place from which his parents had left in 1840 in order to escape what he describes as infamous laws and stupid prejudices. As a family of free people of color, they fled those conditions. But at the same time, Edward's brother Joseph, when he came of age in 1848 in France, he was tempted to come back across the Atlantic and try his luck as a young man on the make, and arriving in New Orleans in the very beginning of 1849 and setting himself up as a cigar manufacturer. So New Orleans had a push, it had a pull, and it was a place that I think was so politically dynamic and interesting, even under circumstances that were difficult, that it really served a very important role in the lives of many families, of which this one is. This story is emblematic. It's not typical, but it is emblematic.
And the Tinchon family played a role in Louisiana history as well.
They did. Edward and his brother Joseph stepped forward during the Union occupation of New Orleans to volunteer to serve in the regiment of men of color that was being raised to continue the fight against slavery and to defend the city against a possible Confederate attack. And he was very proud of that Union service. It was fairly brief. When I actually went into the military records to look for records, I realized this was a rather fleeting unit. It served as a defense of the city for about 60 days. But it was at an important moment. in 1863, and it helped, I think, to establish his identity as a Union veteran and a man of public and principled positions against slavery, which he continued to develop that as his sort of self-identity, his self-presentation. And then he ran for election to the Constitutional Convention in 1867 from Faubourg-Tremé, and he was elected.
I know. It's just this wonderful recovered story. One of the things that comes home to me from all this is how fragile freedom was at that time. The proof was so fragile.
Exactly. We realized that there were moments when people, for example, who had arrived as refugees from Saint-Domingue and who had lived for 10 years as free persons as a result of the abolition of slavery in Saint-Domingue, they ran the risk of re-enslavement on arrival in New Orleans, even though the international slave trade had been banned, even though in principle no one could be brought in to the United States in 1809 as a slave. But exceptions were made, and 3,226 people who had been free in Saint-Domingue were re-enslaved when they arrived in New Orleans. And we often forget that although we think of slavery as a legal status, sometimes it was created kind of out of whole cloth and the exercise of direct power. There was no legal continuity of status for these people. They couldn't hang on to freedom. Others, however, did hold on to their freedom. And Edward's mother, who was a little girl at the time, she was only 11 when she arrived, she did succeed in holding on to her freedom. She had a godmother who took good care of her. But as you know from reading the book, Edward's grandmother, who was an African woman, she probably wisely did not leave for Louisiana when she was expelled from Cuba with all the other refugees. As best we can tell, she took a small boat and returned to Haiti, the one place in which an African woman could be certain that her freedom would not, in fact, be under threat in 1809.
Right. Such an amazing thing to go back. The other thing you said that was so interesting was that part of what makes the book possible, makes reconstructing this history possible, is that this was a family that understood the importance of documentation and creating these documents.
Exactly. I think that people who had experienced slavery and who had lived in Saint-Domingue and realized that you were only as free as you could prove that you were, that documents become absolutely crucial. A free person of color in Saint-Domingue, in order, for example, to go to a notary, always had to show that proof of freedom. One had no right to even begin to notarize a contract or baptize a child as free unless one could show that paper. So I think living in that society, whether one was slave or free, one could see that the people around you were free if they could prove it. They were free if they could prove they had those papers. And so this family, generation after generation, pays close attention to documents. And in New Orleans, as you know, for Edward's mother, Elizabeth, who had no last name, she had no family name because she'd been born out of wedlock. Her father was French, her mother was African, and she had been baptized without a last name. And in 1836, she wants very badly to obtain a last name so that when she signs any document, it won't broadcast her illegitimacy. It won't shadow her with the history of slavery. And so, in fact, her mother, Rosalie, the African woman Rosalie, comes from Haiti with a copy of Elizabeth's baptismal certificate 36 years after the baptism and brings it so that Elizabeth can deposit it with a notary in New Orleans and take on the surname of her father, who had been present at the baptism and had signed the baptismal certificate.
Wow.
So it's not just a freedom paper. It's also, in some cases, papers that will prove respectability, papers that will document parentage. And in this case, it's particularly interesting because that moment when Rosalie brings the document to Elizabeth, it both embodies Elizabeth's desire to be respectable, to have a first name and a last name, but also her continued solidarity with her mother. It's not that she's distancing herself from Africa, because a few weeks later, Elizabeth baptizes one of her children in the cathedral in Saint-Louis, and she asks the African-born Rosalie to stand there as godmother at that baptismal font. So she's doing both things. She's moving herself into respectable society of free people of color, but she's also reinforcing that tie with her own mother.
Well, it's an utterly amazing story. Thank you so much. We've been speaking with historian Rebecca Scott, who is the co-author of Freedom Papers, An Atlantic Odyssey in the Age of Emancipation. You can meet her with her co-author, Jean Hébrard, Thursday, March 1st at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Thanks so much, Rebecca.
Very welcome. It's been a real pleasure.
This is my right, a right given by God. Live a free life, to live in freedom. Talking about freedom. Talking about freedom.
Candace Proctor is a woman of many identities in both life and work. She's a wife and mother of two daughters. She's lived in Europe, the Middle East, Australia, and now for quite a while she's been at home in New Orleans. She's been a university professor, an archaeologist, a partner in an international business consulting firm, and now a writer of many books. And her writing appears under many different names. She's written scholarly works and historical romances as Candace Proctor, writes a series of thrillers with her husband Steve Harris under the pseudonym C.S. Graham. And we're here to talk with her about her mystery set in Regency England, which she writes as C.S. Harris. Whoa, Candace! Welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you.
That's a lot of biography. You think a complicated life makes for...
Makes me sound almost schizophrenic or something.
No. It's made you a good writer, right?
I suppose.
Now, your new book, When Maidens Mourn, comes out March 6th, and it's the seventh in the Sebastian St. Cyr series. What attracts you to Regency England?
It's a time that I think has a lot of similarities to our own, in that it was a society that was really in a state of transition from the more vibrant, morally lax 18th century into the very repressed, almost prudish, well, in fact, literally prudish society of the Victorians. And like most societies that are in a period of transition, it was under stress. Mm-hmm. And there were people were having to adjust to the Industrial Revolution, which increased stresses. It was a time of war. Britain had been at war against Napoleon at that point for 20 years. And so it was also a time of the introduction of new philosophical and political ideas. So it's a period that's very vibrant, very contradictory in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. It's very attractive from that standpoint. And I think it's also attractive to us for many of the same reasons that, say, Jane Austen movies are attractive today, because out of all of the periods in history up until recently, this was a time when people wore clothes that were fairly comfortable, fairly mm-hmm. easy to maneuver in. And I think that as modern readers that we can relate perhaps better to this period than, say, to the stuffier men and women of the Victorian age, or women wearing their hair piled up, powdered and patched like in the 18th century. So it personally appeals to me. And it also appeals to me as a historian just because it is such a fascinating period of transition.
Mm-hmm. So set the scene for us a bit. Tell us about your characters, Sebastian St. Cyr and Hero Jarvis. They're newlyweds in this outing, which is set in 1812.
Well, Sebastian is a Viscount, the son of an Earl. He spent 6 years in the army in the war, and he is somewhat psychologically damaged as a result of the things that he saw and the things that he did. And in many ways, I think that the series is the story of his redemption and that he's done things that almost destroyed him. And solving mysteries is a way for him to work out who he is and to give something back to society that he maybe feels like he failed. And so he's a very contradictory character, very much in contrast, I think, to his wife, who's also a very strong character. But Hero sees the world a lot more in black and white than Sebastian does. Sebastian's very much a man who's always very conscious of the grays and the subtleties, whereas Hero's a lot more assured.
It's a gift to call a woman Hero, isn't it?
It is, yes.
I'm sure you loved it when you thought of that. And this book also has these deep literary allusions to Arthurian legend, to the Tennyson family, to the Lady of Shalott. How did that all come to you and come together?
I practice yoga every morning to Lorena McKennett CD that I have, and the very last song on the one I have is The Lady of Shalott. And I was intrigued by this image of this woman who lived in a castle and only saw life as reflected in a mirror. And it, perhaps having been a historian and a writer for so many years of my life, I saw it as a reflection of the life that writers can end up living, that they write about life, but they're not really experiencing it. So that's when the person of the Gabrielle Tennyson, who was the victim in the book, began to take place in my mind as a woman who was a writer and an intellectual and began to feel that she was missing things from life. And I thought, well, since the story idea was inspired by the poem, I thought, well, it would be fun to have the body discovered floating in a boat on a body of water. And it was just by chance that I discovered that there actually is a site right near London that some people think actually was the historical Camelot. It's called Camlet Moat. And then I thought, oh, it'd be fun, since I have all these illusions, to have her be a Tennyson. And it snowballed from there. A lot of it was serendipity, things that I would find as the more I investigated it and researched it, that I think, oh, I can add that. So it ended up being a lot of fun to write, because the Arthurian legends, of course, are a very rich source of inspiration.
But you're 7 books in now. How long do you see staying with these characters and keeping this going?
Well, I have like 4 or 5 ideas of murder mysteries that I'm anxious to write that are tied to historical events that are coming up.
Now, you've also written 3 novels with your husband, Steve Harris.
Yes.
And he's a former Army intelligence officer. And that's something you know a good deal about from your own background as well, from your father, right?
Yes, my father was in intelligence as well in the Air Force. So
tell us a little bit about that series.
It's a contemporary series, a thriller series. The first one is The Archangel Project. Mm-hmm. The second one is The Solomon Effect. And the third one is
The Babylonian
Codex, yes. The idea for that came from the remote viewing program, which was a very real program that the United States government was involved in. It started out very slowly after the Second World War, when they discovered that the Germans in the Second World War had been investigating the use of psychic abilities to collect intelligence. And the heroine of the book is a remote viewer.
Now explain what that is.
They call it remote viewing, but it actually involves more than viewing. It's basically an individual who has both a latent talent and has been trained, sits in a dark room and accesses their mind and goes into what has a lot of similarities with the meditative state. Mm-hmm. And in their mind, they can, if they're given a target and focus on that target, they can see it, they can hear it, they can smell it, they can taste it. It sounds really woo-woo and very unreal, but it, as I said, it was investigated and defined by a couple of physicists at Stanford, and it's been proven real. It has, unfortunately, some real drawbacks in intelligence gathering, in that intelligence works best when it's verifiable. Mm-hmm. And the targets that remote viewing works best with are ones that are hard to verify the information. And bad intelligence is more dangerous than no intelligence at all, as we saw in the Iraq War. So that's one of the reasons that it was eventually abandoned by the government. Or at least they say it was abandoned.
But it's
really
a fertile
know.
Field for fiction
yes.
anyway. Oh, Candace, I love these books. They're so entertaining, and it's so easy to become really captivated by these characters, and you grow to care about them so much over time. So I hope you write many, many more of them.
Hope so.
We've been talking with Candace Proctor, who writes as C.S. Harris. Her new book is When Maidens Mourn, due out March 6th, where Shadows Dance, the previous novel in the series, comes out in paperback on that date. You can meet her at Garden District Bookshop March 10th from 2 to 4. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It was nice to be here.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Constance Adler signs My Bayou, New Orleans Through the Eyes of a Lover, tonight, February 28th, starting at 6 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, historian Rebecca Scott, and her co-author, Jean Ebrard, discuss and sign Freedom Papers, An Atlantic Odyssey in the Age of Emancipation, Thursday, March 1st at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Roger Kamenetz reads from his forthcoming collection of poems, The Very Rich Hours, featuring music with Anna Byers and Ben Sandmel, and art by Michael Hoftka. That's part of 17 Poets Literary and Performance Series, Thursday, March 1st at 8 p.m. at the Goldmine Saloon. Savor Literacy 2012 offers a taste of New Orleans' great food Thursday, March 1st from 5 to 7 at the Pocket Park on the Tulane campus. Tickets are available at the door and you can taste delicious food from local restaurants, all benefiting STARE, Start the Adventure in Reading. And don't forget Fantasy on the Bayou, that conference for writers and fans of all things fantasy, futuristic, and paranormal, March 2nd through 4th at the New Orleans Marriott Hotel. Special guests include best-selling author and keynote luncheon speaker Maggie Shane, Bob Mayer, Kristen Painter, Leanna Renee Heber, Diana Rowland, and literary agents and editors from New York Publishers and ePress. You can find out more about registration and fees at fantasyonthebayou.blogspot.com. And on Sunday, March 4th, there will be a book signing from 9 to 11 a.m. that's open to the public. Artist Lynn Emery signs the new book, Lynn Emery, with authors Philip Palmedo and John Barrett, Friday, March 2nd from 6 to 8 p.m. at the New Orleans Museum of Art, and again Saturday, March 3rd at 6 p.m. at Arthur Roger Gallery. Poets Arthur Pfister, Mona Lisa Saloy, and LaBertha McCormick read their work Saturday, March 4th at the Poetry Buffet at 2 p.m. at Ladder Library. Jonathan Franzen, author of Freedom and the Corrections, is the next in the Great Writers series at Tulane University. Franzen discusses and signs his work Monday, March 5th at 7 p.m. in McAllister Auditorium at Tulane. There will be an open mic reading Sunday, March 4th at 3 p.m. at the Maple Leaf Bar. Kim Wohl discusses and signs her books, New Orleans Classic Brunches and the James Beard Foundation's Best of the Best, Tuesday, March 6th at 6 p.m. at Garden District Bookshop. Join the First Tuesday Book Club when they discuss Taya Obrett's The Tiger's Wife, Tuesday, March 6th at 6 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple. Architect and professor John Klingman discusses and signs New in New Orleans Architecture, Tuesday, March 6th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Poet Niyo Sundari reads from his book, City Without People, March 6th at 7 p.m. at the Columns Hotel as part of the 1718 reading series. And today's guest, Candace Proctor, who writes as C.S. Harris, signs her book, When Maidens Mourn, Saturday, March 10th from 2 to 4 at the Garden District Bookshop. Major support for The Reading Life is provided by Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org or email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org. Thanks for listening and keep reading.